It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, it may seem like an impossible order sometimes, one fast, nutritious meal for a family that's easy to clean up, but it doesn't have to be impossible. We get tips and one-pan recipes from Carla Snyder, a cookbook author, freelance food writer, and blogger. Her latest book is One Pan Whole Family, More Than 70 Complete Weeknight Meals. Welcome to the show, Carla.
Thanks for having me.
So what was your goal in creating this a book like this that's tailored specifically to feeding a family?
My goal was to help people get dinner on the table. I'm a mother of three, grandmother of four, and I just knew that my kids were having such a hard time getting home from work, getting a nice, you know, healthy meal on the table. And if they were having trouble, so are a whole lot of other people. And so, you know, that's pretty much why.
So what do we need to keep in mind when we get into the kitchen? How can we prepare and cook efficiently?
Well, I think one of the most important things is to be prepared, you know, to be sure that you just pull out all of your ingredients that you're going to use and have them sitting there on the counter so that you can cook a little with a little bit more proficiency. And the other thing is to read the recipe all the way through before you start. That's always a good step because then you kind of know if you're missing an ingredient and you're going to have a panic moment right in the middle of it. And use easy-to-use things, some quick things, some convenience items. Just throw a few in. Cook with some as much fresh as you can, but then use something like par-cooked brown rice, spice blends, things like that that'll save you time.
But that reading the recipe all the way through, you don't want to have any kind of gotcha moments there where, oh, shoot, I should have had this ready. It can get really frustrating sometimes if you make that mistake.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's a big reason why a lot of people don't like to cook, you know, because it gets stressful. So any way that you can eliminate the stress, you know, as much as you can. Plus, I like to kind of get things started. Like I watch my grandkids 2 days a week. So I make dinner for them to take home when they pick up the kids. So I'm still cooking for everybody in a couple of days a week. And I start when the 1.5-year-old is in bed, and I start getting a few things pulled together. And that really helps, too, whether you have to do that in the morning before you head for work or the night before, just kind of get a little bit of a lay of the land. And that really helps then when you have to, you know, hit the ground running.
You've shared one recipe with us that I think speaks to the kid in all of us. It's a mac and cheese dish. Tell us about the idea behind the development of cheesy mac with spinach and ham.
Well, you know, everybody likes macaroni and cheese, right? And I wanted to make one that was all homemade, you know, with all fresh, you know, good, wholesome ingredients, but where you didn't have to cook the macaroni separately. And I just really like this because we're going to use something like, chicken broth or something like that to actually cook the macaroni in all in one pan. Like you don't have to make the cheese sauce, boil the macaroni in another pan, and then combine them, which kind of like, I don't know, it just makes more than one dirty pan, which I find unacceptable for dinner. And I wanted to throw some spinach in there, too, because with all that cheese, like, the kids aren't even going to notice that there's, you know, they're not going to notice the taste. They will notice the color. And then a little bit of ham, just kind of beef it up, right?
Right. And so if you're hungry, if your family's extra hungry, is something that we can pair with this to give them a little extra boost?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and all the recipes have a little extra hungry kids. Little tip. And for this, you know, I say add a side of microwaved frozen peas or green beans on the side. Let's get some more vegetables in those kids.
Vegetables are good, although I remember my mother telling me, eat your carrots, it'll put color in your cheeks. And I said, who wants orange cheeks?
That's exactly right.
And yet I'm still here. We had a fun time around the dinner table. It was finish your food. There are starving children in China, and my response was name two. My father was laughing too hard to administer the appropriate discipline. One thing that's fun that you suggest is beverage pairings for adults and for younger family members. What goes with cheesy mac and spinach and ham?
I think they might like a mocktail of carrot juice, pineapple juice, and sparkling water. Something that I do with my grandkids all the time, they love, we call it fizzy water. And so I always cut their juice with water.
Okay.
And so
some fizzy water and carrot juice and fruit juice. We have to get to a break here. Carla Snyder is a cookbook and author. Her latest book is One Pan Whole Family, more than 70 complete weeknight meals. What's your go-to one-pan meal? Let us know. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Carla Snyder is a cookbook author. Her latest book is One Pan Whole Family, more than 70 complete weeknight meals. Okay, Carla, let's turn to another meal you've suggested, which really zeroes in on a love of Italian cuisine. What was your goal in creating Tuscan chicken with sun-dried tomatoes and mushrooms?
I was trying to get something that would be a little bit more appealing to adults, perhaps, but would still be palatable to children. And one of the things that I do in this book is to give you options, you know, things that you can add or remove. If you know your kids aren't going to eat the sun-dried tomatoes, add them after you serve the children. Little things like that, but mostly just wanting to make something really delicious for a cold weather evening, you know? Beans are so good.
Well, it sounds delicious. What all is in it?
Well, you've got, you know, an onion that you've sauteed up with a carrot and a little bit of celery and some mushrooms and garlic. So you've got a really great flavor base going there. And then you're just going to add a little bit of white wine or chicken broth and some chicken breast, cannellini beans and a little bit of diced sun-dried tomatoes and rosemary. And it just kind of makes a little stew. It's really quick. This dinner's ready in about 45 minutes start to finish.
You know, I did have breakfast, but my mouth is watering right now.
Yeah, it's so good.
Well, there are one of the things I meant to ask earlier, but I think this is a good place to bring it in. Talk about the tools that we should really have in the kitchen in order to be successful with the recipes in your book.
I think one of the most important things you can have in the kitchen is a decent sized cutting board and a good knife. I see most of my friends who are home cooks trying to cut up everything for dinner with a paring knife, and that just, you know, takes forever. So if you can find it within your budget to buy a decent 8-inch Santoku style knife, I think it makes cutting up vegetables ever so much easier. And then having a good 12-inch skillet, something good and heavy that can go right into the oven from the stovetop, is a wonderful tool. What else? A good peeler. I mean, there's such a variety of peelers out there, and I just got a really good one. It's so sharp, and it just always just cuts right in there and peels. Little things like that can really make a difference into whether you really feel like peeling that potato or whether you're just going to say, forget it.
Yeah, you really do need a good quality knife. If you're going to spend some extra money on one thing in your kitchen, I certainly would recommend a knife. That the first really good knife my mother gave me really made a big difference in the way I cooked. This isn't your first work that's celebrating the art of cooking with one pan. Why do you think there's something so appealing about using just one thing to make a really delicious meal?
Well, I think, you know, I love to cook, but I hate to clean up. So I think, well, just imagine how much people who don't really enjoy cooking hate to clean up. I mean, you know, at least I kind of enjoy the process. So I'm trying to make it easier and just streamline the process so that you don't have a sink full of dirty dishes. Just one pan cleanup, just, I know it's really made a difference in my life. And just makes things move through, you know, when you're done eating, then you have to clean up. I hate that, you know, so this makes it faster. I can clean up in 5 minutes.
So what would you say to encourage someone who gets home after a hard day at work and just looks at this task of preparing a meal as kind of like, oh, gosh, this is just the last straw. I'm calling for takeout. What would you say to them to encourage them to actually put in a little bit to get something on the table that you've made yourself?
I'd say, you know, always have certain things in your refrigerator and in your pantry. Always have onions, carrots, and celery. Parsley is great to have as well because it really adds a flavor boost to just about anything that you add it to. And then have some things like canned tomatoes, canned beans, and then, you know, and pasta, you know, and rice, and maybe some farro, things like that. If you always have stuff like that and you have some chicken breasts in the freezer, you know, maybe some bacon in the drawer in your refrigerator, you know, just some things around like that, you can pull some kind of dinner together at the last minute.
Ah, and that is often when we do it. Carla Snyder is a cookbook author, freelance food writer, and blogger. Her latest book is One Pan Whole Family, More Than 70 Complete Weeknight Meals. Thank you so much, Carla, for joining me this morning.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Turns out we're more likely to trust commercial airline pilots with Midwestern accents than those with Southern accents, according to a recent study. But just what is the Midwestern accent? And for that matter, what is the Wisconsin accent? Well, we have a linguistics professor who will weigh in and tell us it's more nuanced than the stereotypes. Do you have a Wisconsin accent? What do you like about it? What have you noticed other people like about it? What do people say about your accent when you're outside of the Badger State? Are you ever confused for a Minnesotan or even a Canadian? And does that bother you? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. ideas@wpr.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR. Mornings. Joe Salmons is a co-director of the University of Wisconsin Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He's also a professor of language sciences. Joe, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show today.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Because we're focusing on accents today, I wanted to make sure that we got this out of the way first. What is the difference between an accent and a dialect?
Oh, that's a really good question. An accent refers basically to pronunciation, whereas dialect involves words and sentence structures and things like that. So I'm from the South, and you may hear it to some extent or other, have a Southern accent, but I also use different words. I use different pronouns. I say y'all instead of you for a plural. I have a different grammar. I can say things like you might should do that. Accent is a much more focused term.
Well, I have to say that your accent doesn't sound very Southern to me, but maybe after we talk for a while, I'll pick that up. So what are the characteristics of the Wisconsin accent as we know it today?
Well, it's changing very rapidly, and they're very new, first of all. So things are just, in some ways, starting to emerge. A couple of things that you hear a lot in Wisconsin include people having a distinctive pronunciation of the A vowel, of the vowel in bad and bat and so forth, specifically when it comes before a G. So people will talk about the stereotype of Wisconsinites, how Wisconsinites say bag. That's one thing that is pretty distinctive. You hear it some in Minnesota and through the Dakotas and in some parts of Canada, but that's pretty well associated with Wisconsin for a lot of people. Other things are coming through right now. So most Americans still have a distinction between the man's name Don and the woman's name Dawn, or words like caught, C-O-T, and caught, the past tense of to catch. But that's going away, and it's going away pretty fast, and that's something that's happening right now in the state.
Well, these things evolve all the time, don't they? I mean, our language is constantly changing. The words we use are constantly evolving. It would make sense that the way we say things does, too. Do these happen? What causes this evolution?
Well, there is... has always been, as far as we can tell, a huge amount of variability in language. Like you say, things are always changing, but there's also a big pool of variables in speech. Not everybody here speaks the same way, so we've got these opportunities to pick up on things and to change in one direction or another. And a lot of these changes that are happening are things that have been going on for a very, very long time. So the change with the avowel, that's a characteristic that English has had since before it was really English. It goes back to the family. It's been happening for 2,000 years in some sense. And it's not exactly the same change because we're starting from different points, but it's going. So it really is this, it's very constant. What direction we go in is determined a lot by adjusting to our peer groups. So it's not necessarily that we try to sound like, but we don't try to sound like people on the radio or the television necessarily. We tend to adjust ourselves to the people we're close to peer groups, to people we identify with. And as you change who you interact with, that gives you new targets to aim for.
We asked people to leave us a voicemail saying a particular sentence so that you could assess just how many Wisconsin characteristics they exhibit. Let's go to, we've got an example from Pam, who's from Whitewater. Let's hear that.
The latest ag report shows strong production, but with the hot weather now, Don knows there's bad news coming today.
So, Joe, what are you hearing here?
So she doesn't have that much of the – so an ag report, it sounds to me like ag, and I looked at it phonetically, it looks like ag. So she doesn't have that much of that particular characteristic. She has another characteristic that we find a whole lot now in people from eastern Wisconsin, basically east of Madison and up along Lake Michigan. Pretty far north, and that is in words like news. She says the Z at the end, more or less like an S, so it sounds like noose. A lot of Americans do that variably, occasionally, but a lot of Wisconsinites in that part of the state are now doing that pretty regularly. It's a pretty common feature of her speech, and she does that. She does it pretty often.
I've always been told that replacing the Z with the Z sound with an S is kind of a product of the Scandinavian heritage of a lot of the people who settled in Wisconsin in the 19th century.
That's what you hear in Scandinavian communities, and if you go to German communities, they'll say, "Oh, that's because we're German." Or if you go to Polish communities, they'll say, "Oh, that's because we sound Polish." A whole lot of languages that were brought by immigrants to the state in the 19th century and into the 20th century don't have a Z sound, especially at the ends of words. And so it was not one group necessarily. It does show up in those particular areas, but it's sort of solidified from those areas and has now become a broad regional pattern. It's found, by the way, outside of the east, but I mentioned the eastern part of the state because it's particularly strong there.
Okay. Let's take a phone call. John is joining us from Richland Center. John, good morning.
Good morning. I lived in Wisconsin all my life. I survived 60 winters here, and I would like to say I am a Midwestern. Two words. I'm from Milwaukee, and the old-timers used to say I am from Milwaukee, and we have the D's, days, and don'ts. D's is these. Days is they, and don'ts is do not.
And John, thanks for that. Also, I've heard people drop the L from Milwaukee, so that it comes out like Milwaukee. It's like people who, instead of saying Baltimore, they say Baltimore.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot going on there. the replacement of W sounds by V sounds is something that you have a lot with bilinguals. I'm working now with a lot of recordings of Norwegian Americans from Wisconsin who are bilinguals, and you get that in their speech. It doesn't survive that much in monolingual speech once people become only English speaking. They don't tend to have that usually. With the what we often call dim, dare, and does, so them, there, and those, that's a very strong feature, much like the S pronunciation. That's one that has immigrant roots. A lot of these languages that were brought to Wisconsin early on don't have the TH sounds, th and the, like we do, and they're very hard for adults to learn, and so people made that replacement. And again, it's a case where a feature was not limited to one group. It was found across a lot of groups, and that makes it easier to get into ordinary speech. But what's happened in that case is it's now, John rightly points out that it's an old Milwaukee feature. Today, it's become, for a lot of people, more identified with rural parts of the state. When I give talks around the state and ask people who says dim, dare, and does, people, whether it's a rural area or an urban area, a lot of people will say, oh, that's something that is more rural today. And with Milwaukee pronounced very briefly, that's a wonderful example. Words that we use a whole lot, we tend to say faster. We shorten them. If you're from a place and the place has a long name, then you've got a really good opportunity to shorten it. So Milwaukee is a perfect example. Louisville in Kentucky, Baltimore, the example you gave, those are really good ones. I think there's a beautiful study to be done taking people from Wisconsin places like Manitowoc and Oconomowoc and see if they pronounce their own city shorter than people from other parts of the state do.
Well, one of the things I miss about the Milwaukee Brewers being in the American League is getting a chance to hear Bob Uecker say the Baltimoreals. We're talking about that Wisconsin accent that we have, whether we know it or not, and we are going to continue that discussion. Joe Salmon stays with us as we talk about what makes someone from Wisconsin sound, well, like someone from Wisconsin. That conversation will continue after the news. Also, Wisconsin Attorney General candidates Brad Schimmel and Josh Call will debate for the first time this Friday night at 7:30. WPR brings you the debate live, moderated by Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg and WPR's Sean Johnson. Ahead of that debate, join us for a special that looks at the Wisconsin candidates for U.S. Senate. That's Friday night at 7, followed by the debate at 7:30. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, you know, when you hear it, it's the Wisconsin accent.
The latest ag report shows strong production, but with
the hot weather now.
Don knows there's bad news coming today.
Don knows there's bad news coming today.
Don knows there's bad news coming today.
Some words just bring out the Scotty in us. Do you and your friends from other places argue over the correct way to say certain words? And what do you think makes the Wisconsin accent different from the way Minnesotans sound or the way Canadians talk, eh? Did you grow up speaking like a Scotty, or did you pick it up later after you moved here? Give us a call and let us know. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, all that will be less fun. ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings, but if you tweet us, be sure to do it in a Wisconsin accent. Joe Selmans is a co-director of the University of Wisconsin Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He's with us today to help us sort out this whole Wisconsin accent thing. So, Joe, what did you hear in that little montage there?
Well, I heard some pretty classic features. The ag report, you have the egg sound, where if you take that word out, the short form of agriculture, and you just play that for people, a couple of the speakers will be interpreted by especially non-Wisconsinites, but to a certain extent Wisconsinites, as having said egg, the thing that a hen lays, and the thing that a lot of people are making for breakfast right now, probably. Another thing that's clear in all three speakers is that in a sentence, the name was the woman's name, Dawn. But all three of those speakers sound to me like they're saying Don. And I played the clips for a couple of Wisconsinites and non-Wisconsinites yesterday, and they all heard, in almost every case, the man's name Don. So that shows that recent change is coming through pretty pretty clearly in those three speakers.
Is this something that's pretty common across the state? I know that from talking with other linguists over the years on other programs, there is a lot of regional variation based on what the ethnic heritage is of a particular part of the state. But are there certain characteristics that are just true no matter where you are in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and this is one, the Don Dawn thing is something that we used to think of as coming in from the west and sort of sweeping eastward, but it looks like it's popping up all over the place now. There are definitely regional differences within the state in accent and otherwise. In the southeast corner of the state, you get people pronouncing the A vowel in words like bad and mad and so forth, more like what you would hear in Chicago or Cleveland or places like that. So you get kind of a bad sound. And in that same southeastern corner, for hockey, people will say something a little bit more like hacky, so a little closer to hacky. Not as extreme as it would be in Detroit or Chicago, but tending that way, and enough so that it will sound different than a lot of the state.
Let's go to the phones. Liz is ready to join us in Viroqua. Liz, let's hear from you this morning.
Yes, I have a question for your guest. I have the first two volumes of the Dictionary of American Regional English, and I think it takes me through the letter H. You obviously know about this work. Is the whole thing done yet?
The whole thing is done, yes. And thank you for raising that, talking about the Dictionary of American Regional English. Today is Frederick Cassidy Day. Frederick Cassidy was a professor in English here. He started the project. He did sound recordings in the 1950s that led up to the recordings for the dictionary in the 1960s. It's all done. We have recordings from every part of the United States made basically from 1968 to 1971. It's a huge resource for all of us. If you have access to most libraries, you can get DARE, as we call the Dictionary of American Regional English, online. So you can search online for particular words, and a lot about pronunciation, a lot about grammar and so forth, too. It's a huge resource, and it's a wonderful thing that comes from Wisconsin.
Liz, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Lisa in Delavan. Lisa, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Well, good morning. Happy, is it Frederick Cassidy Day?
Yes.
Happy Frederick Cassidy Day. I didn't know all that my students
know. Is there a greeting card for this day, too?
I don't think there is, but we have one, don't you think?
Really?
We moved here in 2002 from California. I grew up as a military dependent. My dad was in the Air Force for 20 years. Grew up everywhere. I kind of think I don't have an accent. My students think I have a southern accent. I don't personally hear that very often. But we have three children. They're all grown now, our oldest and our youngest. Their dialect really didn't shift at all, but our middle child, who is a CPA in Madison, and Ellen, if you're listening, this is Mom, she absolutely sounds like she was born and raised here all of her life. And she was probably, I think, sixth grade when we got here. And it's just really shifted. And it's interesting to see within our family, within our household, you know, one child adopting that dialect and the others. Is there a reason for that? I mean, is there... What is it about us that makes us more prone or susceptible to adapting our dialect when we move as children?
Really good question. That's an area where there's a huge amount of research happening right now. Kids can adjust, and a lot of kids do adjust. And Sixth grade is pretty much a perfect time for somebody to realign themselves. Some of it has to do with the peer group associations. In that pre-adolescent, adolescent time, you really have very strong peer groups, and you really want to sound like and be like your friends. So it probably goes back to who they were hanging out with and what kind of accents those people had. But that's a very common thing within families, to get differences within a set of siblings.
Lisa, thanks. Thanks for that call. Is it true some people are just sort of natural mimics and they tend to just blend in? I find myself doing this. Whatever group I'm with, after an hour, I find myself talking the way they do, and I just pretty much can't even help myself, which makes a lot of my Canadian friends really laugh when they hear me say a boot or something like that. But are some of us more prone to just kind of blend in that way?
It's the easiest question of the morning, for sure. Yes. Some people are really good at it, but as we get older, once we're past our early 20s, it's harder to pick up certain things. So you can get the basic patterns, but if you study somebody's speech, you can tell even somebody who moves to a new place, say in their teens, in a lot of places they will basically sound like they're from there, but if you really investigate all of the details of their speech, you'll see that there's some things they haven't adjusted to, they haven't picked up on. So some people are clearly much better at it, and I envy those people, I have to confess. There are limits to how good we are at that.
And I also noticed that Lisa pronounced the T in often. Is that a regional thing, and where is it from?
Oh, that is not a regional thing.
Okay.
The word historically never had a T in it, but when English spelling got set, they put a T in it, and it's what we call a spelling pronunciation. And I normally don't have many spelling pronunciations. I was giving a public talk a couple of years ago, and somebody asked exactly that question, and I said, oh, that shouldn't be there. That's only people who pay too much attention to spelling. And 10 minutes later in the Q&A, the whole audience just went crazy laughing, and I said, what? And they said, oh, you just said often.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, I'm glad to get that question answered. Let's hear from Mark in Oconomowoc next. Mark, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Hi. Greetings. There is no I wanted to make a couple comments. One was about Manitowoc and Oconomowoc, whether we're tempted to shorten it up by dropping a consonant or vowel. Not yet out here. After 25 years, they do refer to the town as Cooney, but that's their sports name, but based on Oconomowoc. But next to Manitowoc, they definitely, where I used to live, have shortened that up from Two Rivers to Trivers, so they kind of contract that. But the comment that question I have is, having studied German and Norwegian, ST and SP are often pronounced in those countries with a SH sound, like spiel or shtick. But my daughter is now, in the last couple of years, talking about going to strength training, and I'm wondering where this SH creep has come from, if it's a local thing or a national thing or just a sloppy thing. But I hear it even on news programs from national TV, so I'm wondering if it's what your opinion is on that.
It's something that's happening all over the country, and it's a really interesting change for a whole set of reasons. The example you gave is perfect strength. The sentence that the people read had the word strong in it, and if you go back and listen to the three of them, one of them had pretty much a sh, one was sort of in between, and one had a s.
Yeah, that drives me crazy when I hear that.
It's spreading, and I'm sorry, but you're not going to stop it. It's just in two generations, it's gonna be the norm. But it's very specifically for most people, like in strength and strong, it's in the cases with S, T, and R. Some people have generalized it to just S, T, or S, P type things, but it's mostly when there's an R following.
I guess I had either the fortune or misfortune of being raised by a radio announcer to have good diction, and so it bothers me when I don't hear it. We are going to continue our conversation with Joe Salmons about this Wisconsin accent thing. Do you think you have a Wisconsin accent? And if so, how does it manifest itself? Are you maybe a recent transplant? What do you think about how we talk up here in the North, eh? When we come back, I want to talk about the difference between the actual accent and the stereotype, which I just illustrated. And we've got some other stuff to do too. So lots to come here on the morning show. So stick around with us. Joe Salmons is co-director of the University of Wisconsin Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. 800-642-1234. Tell us about your Wisconsin accent. I'm John Munson. This is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Well, you know it when you hear it. It's the Wisconsin accent.
The latest ag report shows strong production, but with the hot weather now, Don knows there's bad news coming today.
Some words just bring out the Scotty. Do you and your friends from other places argue over the correct way to say certain words? And what do you think makes the Wisconsin accent different from the way Minnesotans sound or the way the Canadians talk? Did you grow up speaking like a Wisconsinite? Or did you pick it up later after you moved here? Call us at 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. That was WPR's own Rich Kramer, our reporter from Eau Claire, who grew up in Superior. And I happen to know this because my wife was his elementary school teacher. Joe Salmon, what did you think of Rich's accent?
You've got some classic features there. One thing that we haven't talked about this morning is the A and O pronunciations that we get a lot. And you can hear it, I think, in all three of those, where in the speech of most Americans, you get something that's fairly diphthongal. You have sort of two vowel qualities. So I say words like say and know, where the vowel quality changes a bunch. But Wisconsinites and Minnesotans will tend to say say and no. They're much more stable. They're much more monophthongal. Those can be taken. So people will talk about the Minnesota O in Wisconsin. And when I first moved here, I thought it was hilarious because I would ask Wisconsinites, well, how do you recognize a Minnesota accent? And they say, oh, they say, oh, funny. And I went to Minnesota and said, how do you recognize a Wisconsin accent? And they said, oh, they say their oh is funny. I couldn't figure out. It sounded like they were both saying the same thing. It turns out that phonetically, there's a little bit of a difference that I'm completely deaf to as an outsider, but that people in this region can hear from each other. They're both very monophthongal to my ear, but if you look at it, if you do a computer analysis of the sound waves, you'll see that they're moving slightly, but they're moving in opposite directions. So that's something that's pretty pervasive, and that's we hear a little bit of that in there.
Let's go next to Lisa, who is calling us from Pittsville. Lisa, hello.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Well, I'm from the Midwest, and I've lived in central Wisconsin all my life. And several years ago, I attended a professional conference, and I was the only one from the Midwest. Everybody else was from the South, and they all complimented me on my accent when I thought they were the ones with the accent, and I was the one without one. And also noteworthy was it was in May, and they were all freezing, and I had my jacket off.
Yeah, you can always tell who the snowbirds are in Arizona in January because they're wearing shorts and everybody else is in a survival parka. What about Lisa's story here, Joe?
I can assure you, everybody has an accent if you go somewhere else. And a lot of times we're not aware of it until we move outside. of the area where we grew up. The perception of different accents is really pretty dramatic across the country, not just in terms of who has one and what we can identify, but also what we think sounds pleasant, what we think sounds correct, and so forth. In Wisconsin, we're really in sort of a sweet spot. There's a really famous set of studies, part of them by Nancy Nijelski, part of them by Dennis Preston, and other people, where they gave people maps of the United States and said, okay, just draw the places where you think people speak the most pleasant English and the most correct English. And they did it with a bunch of Michiganders and a bunch of Alabamians. And the Michiganders thought that Michigan was the most correct, the South was the least correct. And the Alabamians were not too, they pretty much agreed on that. They thought that Northerners sounded much more correct, especially the Midwest. But when it came to pleasantness, everybody agreed that the Southerners sounded pleasant. In Wisconsin, we just recently did a survey. Miranda Wilkerson, a colleague, and I did a survey of almost 2,000 Wisconsinites, and we asked, do you think Wisconsin English sounds friendly? And overwhelmingly, people said yes. We asked, do you think, can you hear a Wisconsin accent? Can you identify somebody who's from Wisconsin? And people said yes, but not quite so powerfully. We also asked, by the way, if people thought that Wisconsin English was correct English, and it dropped down a little bit, not like Alabamians or Michiganders think about Alabama speech, but it was not, people didn't think of Wisconsin English as particularly the most correct English.
A recent survey found that Americans were more likely to trust commercial pilots with Midwestern accents than they were commercial pilots with Southern accents, especially from Texas. Joe, we had a caller earlier who couldn't stay on the line who said he went to China and taught. He's from Wisconsin, and the Chinese loved his accent, and that was the kind of English they wanted to learn how to speak. So what's up with people finding Midwestern-sounding accents more trustworthy?
Well, it's this is not something about language in and of itself. It's something about attitudes toward the region that get reflected in language. We can have completely different reactions to exactly the same linguistic feature, depending on how we think about the particular group. So if we listen to somebody with a British accent and they don't pronounce their R's at the ends of words, that will sound fancy, sophisticated to a lot of Americans. But if we have a Southern stereotypical redneck sheriff doing exactly that same feature, that will signal something very, very different. So it's about the cultural image and attitudes toward an area, toward a set of people, and so forth. And language is just sort of implicated in that. It's not about the language per se.
Let's take a quick call from Dan in Maribel. Dan, go ahead.
Hey, I live in a little village called Maribel, which is really Maribel. But the question I had is there's a town nearby called Wrightstown. And instead of saying you guys, they say you guys. And so it's you guys instead of you guys. I had a friend who worked there and coached basketball. And he kept telling the players, it's you guys, you guys. And then he got to a game and all the parents in the crowd were yelling, go get them, you guys. Go get them, you guys. So I'm wondering where that came from.
Dan, thanks for the call. So you guys, where's that one come from?
So there's a weird thing about English. We have singular versus plural pronouns. So we say I and we and he or she and they and so forth. We don't have that for the second person. So we have you and you in the standard language. It hasn't always been that way, but it's that way now. And different dialects of English have come up with lots of different solutions to that problem by inventing new plural pronouns. In the South, you get y'all, and in the Highland South in Appalachia, you get yuns. Pittsburgh has yens. In parts of the upper Midwest, you get you guys. And for a lot of people, that's not gendered. That refers equally easily to males or females. You get you guys. You also, in certain parts of the state, in northern Wisconsin, for example, I've heard it a lot, you get people just saying use as a use should do this or that.
Mm-hmm. Knowing what we know about how language and accents move and evolve, what changes could we expect to see in the Wisconsin accent in the coming years, do you think?
I predict that it's going to get more distinctive, but it's going to get more distinctive exactly in the ways that your three recordings are. That is, it's not going to be the stereotype Northwoods stuff. It's going to be these subtle changes that we're hearing, the kind of stuff we've been talking about this morning, that are going to get stronger and stronger over time.
Well, we'll have to keep an ear out for that. We left a lot on the table here. We could probably have done several hours on this, and I know our callers enjoyed it, and I sure enjoyed listening to the way we talk, and it's not funny. We don't talk funny, I insist. Joe Selmans is co-director of the University of Wisconsin Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He's also professor of language sciences. Thank you so much, Joe, for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.